Good afternoon, Juneau. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon on KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We have a great lineup of guests today. At Evening at Egan tonight, Sherry Simpson is going to be here, and she's teaming up with Ernestine Haynes to do a wonderful workshop on writing, more or less open to the public. And so that'll be at this evening up at University of Alaska Southeast. They'll be here in a few minutes to talk about that. The Juneau Light Opera has an all-male choir concert coming up tonight as well. So that'll be, we'll have George Partlow and possibly Alan Davis will drop in to talk about that with us too. Nancy Barnes will be here. They have a program getting out the native vote. Brian Graceland is doing music on the fly, or music out at the airport. And Ginny Palmer will be coming by. She's resigning as the three-term president of the Friends of the Alaska State Museum. We'll be talking to her about that. Right now, time for National Native News. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Native American voting rights group is filing a federal court case alleging unequal access to the polls in Jackson County, South Dakota. The county covers a corner of the Pine Ridge Reservation and is home to the towns of Kadoka and Wombly. In Kadoka, the public can register and vote early in person, but in Wombly, early voting in person is not an option. Charles Michael Ray reports.
Eileen O'Connor is an attorney with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. She says the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, provides funding for places like Jackson County to set up satellite voting offices in towns like Wombly. O'Connor says access to the polls should be equal for everyone.
Making it so much easier for the white citizens of Jackson County to take advantage of early voting and of in-person registration than for Native Americans is, as we said in the complaint, a violation of the Voting Rights Act.
According to the most recent U.S. Census data, Native American people now slightly outnumber non-natives in Jackson County. O.J. Siemens with the voting rights group Four Directions helped bring the lawsuit. Siemens says this issue isn't just about equal access, it's about getting equal representation of Lakota people in elected offices.
Getting more Native Americans into the local, county, state, and federal elections. And in order to do this, we need to show them that they have equal access to the ballot box, therefore ensuring that if they want to run, they're going to have people vote for them.
The South Dakota Secretary of State, Jason Gant, has not commented on this litigation specifically. However, Gant points out that early voting is still open to everyone through the mail. He says this issue is not about race or denying anyone the right to vote. Gant says there is ambiguity from the federal government about the proper use of HAVA funds for a voting office of this type.
We do not know 100% from the federal government whether or not those funds are allowed for this activity. So that's why in the HAVA state plan, should the federal government determine it's not an allowable expense, the county would have to pay back that money.
Voting rights advocates with the group Four Directions disagree. They point out that South Dakota revised its own Help America Vote Act plan to specify that Jackson County could use HAVA funds to establish a satellite office. Jackson County Auditor Vicki Wilson refused to comment for this story. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Alaska's past few governors have created policies, initiated legislation, and launched lawsuits challenging tribal sovereignty. As KMBA's Jocelyn Estes reports, Governor Sean Parnell's administration is now taking a more cooperative approach.
The state's proposed civil diversion agreement would authorize state troopers and village public safety officers to divert certain alcohol-related juvenile, domestic violence, or other misdemeanor charges to tribal courts if the offender agrees. That's according to Lisa Yeager, a tribal government specialist with the Interior Alaska Regional Nonprofit Corporation Tanana Chiefs Conference.
It kind of hands a an avenue to tribes to be able to use state resources and sentence people without their people getting, the state record and being able to do it in a restorative justice manner. Tribes already do some of these things, but it's not easy for a state trooper to just cite cases right to tribal courts right now.
The agreement falls short of recognizing tribal sovereignty. Still, It does begin by stating tribes exist in Alaska and goes on to say nothing in the agreement should be interpreted to mean tribes are not sovereign governments. Tribes are reviewing and considering the terms of the agreement. None have signed it yet. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
If you are a Native American, there's one simple thing you can do to help your elders, help young people seeking an education, and help develop Native business. Go out and vote on November 4th. Voting on Election Day makes a difference in Washington, D.C. and at home. Go to nativenews.net for more information. Brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's just 6 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My first two guests are here in the studio right now, but tonight you're going to get a chance to meet them both. Sherry Simpson is down from Anchorage, and Ernestine Hayes is, of course, on the UAS faculty here. And the two of them are going to give a presentation as part of the Evening at Egan program, our Friday night wonderful University of Alaska Southeast lecture series. And they're going to be talking about cultural assumptions in Alaskan literature. So, ladies, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's turn your microphones on so that the radio audience and not just me can hear your voice. There we go. So, give me just a brief synopsis of what you're thinking about doing tonight.
Well, Ernestine has taught me a lot about noticing cultural assumptions in my own writing and other people's writing, and so we wanted to have a conversation in front of other people about what that means and what the effects are and how people can learn to think a little differently.
Ernestine, your book is called Blonde Indian. The title, I think, you know, gives us a clue as to what we're going to be talking about and what's going on in your life. But can you give me a for instance of what touch this conversation off between the two of you?
I think in Alaska literature particularly, we have to deal with cultural appropriation where people who are not Native consider it their right to appropriate and take Native stories and retell them. And sometimes that creates a problem because there's a lack of understanding. Sometimes it makes it creates the impression that stories are only for children when really they're very profound, they have a lot of meaning and so on. And so this whole idea of being able to take cultural and intellectual property is something that I hope we can bring to the attention of writers and readers around Alaska.
So how are you going to approach this with the general public tonight? This is not a writer's workshop, per se. I said something like that when I introduced it in the beginning of the show, but you're really talking to a larger audience that is not writing books. So how are you going to go at this?
Well, we're going to have a conversation with each other, one that we've had in little bits and pieces. I've heard Ernestine talk about it before in a teaching setting, and I've seen that a lot of us don't get it or get defensive or they're just not listening to what cultural appropriation means, why it's damaging, why it matters. And so I had the privilege of learning so much from Ernestine about learning how to think about these things in a different way and be a little bit more aware. So I get to share my mistakes, and Ernestine gets to. Ernestine,
so you're
gets
the crash test dummy.
That's right. Learn from me, my friends. Yeah.
So your writing has been very animal centric in the sense that you tend to be you tend to focus on your experience with animals in Alaska. Mm-hmm. How has if that's the focus, then how has your writing been affected by this discussion?
Well, one element of that is I do write about place a lot, and I am interested in people's ideas about animals and how we respond to them because of those ideas. But in writing about place, I've always struggled myself with that line between acknowledging that there was an entire culture here, mm-hmm. When every sense of the meaning and people here who belong to this land, and as I've learned from Ernestine, have a reciprocal relationship in a way that we're not raised with. So I've struggled with trying to acknowledge that and yet not feel like I'm encroaching on those areas, that I'm not taking too much myself. And I think a lot of people do.
So I'm trying to construct you read her stuff, right?
Yes.
Okay. And were you disturbed?
No.
Oh, okay. All right.
No, when I went up to Anchorage to enter the MFA program up there, Sherry was one of my teachers. She became my advisor.
Uh-huh.
I've always felt that Sherry's writing and Sherry's very spirit is very sensitive and aware, and we've been talking about this for some time, and Sherry shared with me some of the questions that she's thinking about, uh-huh. and I've decided that my answer to every question, because Sherry is so sensitive and knows just by some natural talent how to write about place and people and history with that sensitivity, that every one of my answers is going to be, "That's an interesting question, Sherry. What do you think?"
Yes, but I'm wise to these toys.
So that's the program tonight, folks. Okay. This should be a fascinating conversation between two folks. And now, you're also here kind of under the aegis of a writers group that has some currency in Alaska right now, called 49 Writers, right? Started, I think, in Anchorage.
Yes.
But now it's kind of reached out, and we have a chapter here in Juneau.
The Juneau chapter is so active that Linda Ketchum, who's the executive director now, I guess, of the program, who directs it and does all the sort of nuts and bolts and logistics, she told me that maybe we should move the world headquarters here because Juneau writers are so active.
Well,
and
of course, that's the logical thing to do, Sherry.
Well, that's what I said. Anchorage doesn't have to have everything. But it was started by two writers who lived in Anchorage, Andromeda Romano Lax and Deb Vanasse. And they started with a website, and it made incredible progress in just a couple of years in bringing writers together. And now they are trying to reach out to other Alaskans. They bring in writers from outside, but they're very good at supporting Alaska writers. There's a blog. They sponsor all kinds of events. They're terrific at finding partners. So they've been part of this kind of renaissance, I think. That's not even the right word, because they've helped originate this much bigger community in a way that I had never seen in Alaska until pretty recently. Between them and the Rasmussen Foundation,
mm-hmm.
They've made a lot of opportunities for writers.
And with the also the support of the Alaska Humanities
Yes,
Forum.
Absolutely. They're a big part of this particular enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one of the things I admire about 49 Writers. They're so good at finding partners and making the best use of everybody's resources. So.
Writing is a singular occupation. I mean, you go in a dark room with your computer and you type away, or your typewriter, or your pencil and paper, and it is really wonderful at times to get together with your own kind
right.
and discover that you are not the only one who feels the way you do when you're writing. You
well, know, some so. People call that whining, but we call that supportive. But it's true that we have a writer friend, Joanne Mapson, who came to Alaska from California and lived here for several years and teaches in our low residency program, and she's always said that their Alaska writers are just much nicer and more supportive. It's not nearly as competitive and sort of knock everyone else down so you can get ahead. So
My sense of that is that that is exactly true. So tonight's presentation, two venues up there. Which one are you in? Are you in the big theater setting, or are you down in the library?
We're in the library.
Okay, yeah. All right. It works well. Puts everybody on the same level, kind of, and yeah, it's a very convenient place to have a conversation.
Yeah, it's a privilege to get to be there.
Yeah, that's a really wonderful thing to do with a section of the university library when they did the architecture and set that up that way.
Yeah, and then we should acknowledge the university's been tremendously helpful in this whole pulling this together.
Okay, so the show starts at 7 o'clock, this conversation begins.
Could be a show, we'll
yeah,
see.
Could be, okay, but it's at 7 o'clock, and it's, of course, open to the public, and there's no charge for any of the evening and Egan events. So, and now that the construction has more or less died away, I think there's pretty adequate parking out there in the big parking lot, and it's easy to get to and all like that.
I noticed people feel perfectly comfortable parking on the sidewalks.
That's a Juno thing. Anyway, okay, Sherry Simpson, author of a couple of wonderful, Dominion of Bears, and before that, I can't remember the other two titles, refresh me.
Accidental Explorer and The Way Winter Comes.
Yes, okay. All of which have a kind of a focus on wildlife in Alaska, mm-hmm. but also on wildlife mm-hmm. in Alaska. You have an amazing sense of humor, by the way. It comes through in your writing wonderfully well. Anyway.
We should point out, I think Ernestine's book is really the finest memoir to come out of Alaska, but it's won a huge national award, the American Book Award, and rightfully so.
So, and Ernestine Hayes, on at 7 o'clock tonight at Evening and Egan. Folks, step out. Go see this thing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
This be Bird Note. Ahoy, mateys. It's International Talk Like a Pirate Day. And what's a pirate without his parrot? Although we can't be certain that pirates were especially likely to have parrots, the stories abound. During the golden age of piracy, Europeans were busy exploring the New World, and pirates preyed on the ships plying the waters of South and Central America, home to many species of parrots. Pirates could have easily traded, or raided, for parrots. A parrot would be a perfect companion on a ship. It's small and tidy and makes a wonderful burglar alarm when someone sneaks into your cabin to steal your booty. Arr! No doubt the most famous image of pirate and parrot is Long John Silver in Treasure Island. Long John's parrot, Captain Flint, most likely a yellow-crowned Amazon, went everywhere with him. And he had much to say. So avast there, me hearties. Join us in celebrating Talk Like a Pirate Day. Even if you don't have a parrot. For Bird Note, I'm Captain Buckthorn Crookshank. Ahoy, mateys, and...
Hello, this is Garrison Keillor. The 40th season of A Prairie Home Companion opens September 20th, and KTOO is hosting a listening party where you can join other Prairie Home fans for some streaming video of the show and have a chance to win a trip to see the show in person. It all happens on Saturday, September 20th, so put it on your calendar.
Tickets and information about the event and the accompanying Meatloaf Supper at ktoo.org.
19 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next two guests are going to be performing in a new, unique group for Juneau. This hasn't happened before that I know of. Maybe it has in history, but anyway. George Partlow and Alan Davis are here, and they are part of the Man Choir. So you're performing tonight, right?
Yeah, tonight and tomorrow night.
Okay. Where?
At Holy Trinity.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
On 4th and Harris.
Okay.
So, 7 o'clock.
7 p.m. Yeah. at Trinity. Mm-hmm. Tickets at the door, tickets other places?
Oh, the usual outlets. They're okay. At Hearthside Books, at the Jack, at Rainy Day Books.
Yeah, it's through Vendini. You can also get to them through our website, JunoOpera.org.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, George, you're obviously a beautiful voice of yours is somewhere between the baritone and the bass register, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And Alan, I think you sing.
Well, I sang tenor for a long time, yeah. And then I had a lesson with Byron McGilvray, and he said, you know, you're really a tenor, or excuse me, you're really a baritone,
uh-huh.
based on where my voice breaks.
Uh-huh.
And so I moved down to sing baritone, and it's actually a little more comfortable. But for this group, the first night we had four tenors and I think ten baritone basses. So I moved over to the tenor section to sing for this anyway.
Had to relearn all the parts, of course. Instantaneously.
Well, I hadn't seen them before. So it wasn't
that was easy.
It was easy to do.
Yeah. So how many men are in the choir?
20 or 22. I guess I don't know the exact number.
Between 20 and 25.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And when did you all start putting this together?
4 weeks ago.
Yeah. Okay. Whose idea?
Well, the Lyric Opera was looking around for some kind of workshop, something that hadn't been done before, and somebody suggested a men's choir. And we actually looked around to try and find a conductor to bring in, and it turned out to be kind of expensive. And Richard Moore is on our board, and he said, well, you know, I could do that. And he said he'd really like to do it. So mm-hmm. So we chose him to do it. We had 4 weeks of rehearsals, two nights a week. And it's a nice, cohesive group. And he sort of hinted obliquely that we might just do this again.
Mm-hmm.
Might be a permanent group or something. Nothing is planned at this point, but we're having a really good time.
We'll see what kind of reception we get.
Yeah,
can we get a verbal look at the program here? What will you be singing?
Sure. Well, we're going to be doing a mix of things. We're going to be doing some George Frideric Handel to begin with, some sea chanties. On the bonny banks of Loch Lomond,
mm-hmm.
and the Battle Hymn of the Republic, some African American spirituals. A few solo and small group works. Tom Melville is going to be singing Some Enchanted Evening from South Pacific, which mm-hmm. one of my favorite pieces.
Mm-hmm.
George is doing Deep River.
Ooh, okay.
And I'm in a trio that's doing The Fugue for Tin Horns from Guys and Dolls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wonderful piece of music. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
He's got a horse right here.
Uh-huh. And his name is Paul Revere. Okay. I'm curious, I guess, all of the pieces that you named have, I could hear a male voice doing all of them. Is there a literature of male-voiced, male choir music?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
I used to sing with the Yale Russian Chorus, and we had tons and tons of repertoire, especially Orthodox Church music.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, there's Barbershop. Everybody knows about that.
Yeah.
But most things are available in different arrangements, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, or two tenors and two basses or whatever.
And there are also, you know, correspondingly, there's also two sopranos, two altos arrangements.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. A lot of times of basically the same thing, just right. The voices shifted a little bit.
So the high end of this choir will be in the tenor range, or do you have male sopranos?
No, it's just tenors. And
okay. This is just tenors.
So it's all
yeah.
tenor bass. Okay. All right. So mm-hmm. This will be a real different sound for Juno. We're kind of used to hearing SATV stuff, soprano,
yeah.
alto, tenor
yeah,
bass.
Yeah, and of course we have yeah. the Pride
and
Chorus,
the Pride
which
chorus
is all women.
All women. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, this is kind of unique for yeah. Juno. I do remember a number of years ago there was a group, I don't know if they did concerts, called the Possum Lodge Glee Club.
Hmm.
That was all men. But I think they kind of got together because they liked singing the stuff and did kind of impromptu performances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, went out to the mall and sang or something like that.
Hmm. I'm thinking about how you work with women's voices. You guys, you have to use overhead to project the bass, right? Because it tends not to be as projective as a women's voice, as women's voices.
Well, not really. What you realize is that as you go down, you have to put more energy into the sound, really. And it kind of means that if you're reading in the music that it says you're supposed to be singing piano, you're actually singing mezzo forte.
Yeah.
I apologize to people out there who don't know these
piano
Italian
is
musical mezzo forte terms.
Is about medium volume.
Yeah,
but anyway,
medium loud.
So yeah, so the dynamic is you have to very carefully control the dynamic in order to get the thing to come to like pianissimo, which is extremely soft with all male voices, is probably something that takes a little bit of practice with the group to.
And we've been practicing.
Yeah, yeah. How much?
Twice a week.
Twice a week.
Yeah, we've had 8 rehearsals now so far, and 2 performances.
Now, when you announce this and men start stepping forward, there's a because of the amount of the sheer volume of music that goes on in Juno, you probably didn't have much trouble filling the slots in the choir, except as you said, you had to step over from baritone to tenor to fill
in.
It's always hard to find
a lot more tenors than bass baritones. But yeah, we put out feelers, and the Lyric Opera has an email list of singers, and we sent out notices to everybody we knew about that sang. We didn't have any trouble. I don't think we had a selected number of slots that we were expecting, but see
who shows up,
and it's a good group.
Sort the pieces out. So, you mentioned the director's name, and I should have written it down. Who's that?
Richard Moore.
Okay. So, did he do the coaching, or did you bring in a coach, or were
No, he did. He did the entire thing.
He did the whole thing.
Yeah, he's the choral director at the JDHS.
Okay. Because people may not realize that a big part of the preparation for a concert involves coaching some of the individual singers, because there are people who need a little assist with sorting out some of the technical details and things like that.
Well,
that's
a strong
part of what a good choir director does.
I think most of the people involved in this group already have been involved in other things, like Byron McGilvery's workshops, and they've sung with Juno Lyric Opera and in church choirs and so on, and many of them have a long history of not only singing in choirs but taking voice lessons and doing a lot of solo work. So,
okay, the concert is tonight at 7:00 at Trinity. Tickets in the usual places. This is Juno's. This is the rollout of Juno's Man Choir, first annual.
and if you miss tonight, you get another chance Saturday night, same place, same time.
Excellent. George Partlow, Alan Davis, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention.
Well, thank you, Pat.
I've taken the liberty of snaffling off the original song here for our closeout.
Okay.
We're as different as people can be.
It's true.
And yet you want to marry me.
I do.
I've known you a few short weeks, and yet somehow you've made my heart forget all of the men I have ever met but you.
Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger. You may see a stranger cross a crowded room, and somehow you know even then, that somewhere you'll see her. Again and again.
Who can explain it? Who can tell you why? Fools give you reasons.
Wise men never try. Some enchanted evening.
This is Sarah Radke Brown from the Juno Symphony, inviting you to purchase your season tickets today and let the symphony lead you through a year of exhilarating performances. More information on our exciting candidate season can be found at junosymphony.org. Contact the office at 586-4676 to purchase your tickets and enjoy live symphonic music at its best. This message brought to you by the Juno Symphony.
It's just 3:30, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore hosting today on KTOO for Juneau Afternoon, and we're coming up on the election, folks, and it's really important. This next group has a great message that we need to get out to everybody. I have with me Bulut Kesh from Haida Tlingit. Nancy Barnes is here from Hunatotum. Amber Henderson is here from Hunatotum, and they're all part of a program that is involved in getting out the Native vote. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hey, they're there. So, I guess the first question is the Native vote harder to I've noticed at the end of every one of the National Native newscasts for the last month or so, they've had a piece about voting and the power of voting. Is it harder to get Natives to come to the polls?
I think one of the issues that we're having is that we're discovering that a lot of our people are not registered to vote. And so that is what our main effort is in our Get Out the Native Vote, is getting people registered, updating their registration, making sure that they get to the polls on Election Day.
So this is Bulut mm-hmm. speaking. So how are you going about doing that? What's the drive look like?
This is Nancy. We've been doing voter registration drives all over. We did one at the Oyster Fest, and it's a collaborative effort with a lot of different organizations. And Tuesday night from 5 to 8 o'clock at Elizabeth Paradovich Hall, we're going to have a Get Out the Native Vote rally. Uh-huh. Get people registered. We're going to have dance groups and prizes for everyone who shows up. And it's going to be a great event, and everyone's invited. We'll have probably 6 voter registrars there.
And the nonpartisan organizations that are helping us are Tlingit Haida Central Council, Sea Alaska, Hunatotum Corporation, Tlingit Haida Housing Authority, Ha'ani, UAS. We've also worked with the Juno Votes and the Women
League of Women Voters.
League of Women Voters. And one of the things that we're going to have at our event is you're going to be able to register to vote, update your registration, learn about absentee voting, question ballots contested, learn about ballot initiatives, participate in a mock election, learn about voting definitions and terms. That's one of the things that we discovered with people who are not registered to vote or who are nervous or even scared to do the whole process, is that we have to start from the very bottom and educating them in the whole process and the terms for getting people to understand the voting process, basically. And then absentee advance voting, and then we'll have a media station where you can, talk about your story or why you want to vote or why, you know, what's important to you.
You've been doing this for a while, mm-hmm. Malia. How is it going? What are the numbers looking like so far?
It's a grassroots effort, basically, that we've been, you know, chipping away at the blocks. But I'll let Nancy talk about that.
Okay.
So we need to have everybody registered in voting. There was a 50 7% turnout, meaning 26,000 Alaska Natives in the 2012 election could have voted but didn't. Mm-hmm. That's substantial. 26,000.
Mm-hmm.
We want them all registered. So that's our goal.
And then you said something about getting people to the polls. The next speaker said she was absolutely not going to talk at all. And so now here's Dixie, who is going to tell us a little bit about this, too.
Well, you know, over the years, one of the things that we have, that I've seen personally, is when people move from the rural areas into the urban centers, that they're not carrying that that voting right with them. They're not updating their registration, and they are not participating in that process. And so somehow they either keep that connection back home by keeping their voter registration tied back to their smaller communities and not using the power of their voice in the urban centers. And I think that's one of the challenges, is that it's a vitally important step when you move into a new area outside of your hometown, is that you carry that voting right with you and make sure that you're eligible. And I think that's one of the challenges that we're seeing. The rural populations are really exercising their right to vote, but when this demographic of people come together in the urban centers, you see it's a little bit less resonating.
Yeah. Okay. We just have a couple of seconds here. I want to make absolutely certain we get the word out here. What do people need to do immediately? What's the next step for everybody?
Well, they need to come to our event on Tuesday, September 23rd, from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Elizabeth Pradovich Hall. We'll have light snacks, dance performances, door prizes for all who attend. And it's part of the National Voter Registration Day, which is September 23rd, but we're having, nationally, there's a action week for Get Out the Native Vote.
Okay. So this is the critical thing, then, Tuesday night. If Tuesday night is booked and they can't possibly get there, how else can they go about getting some assistance if they feel like they're confused, or they need some help, or they need somebody to step in and help them get registered to vote?
Well, they can contact any one of our organizations, and we can help them with their registration, as well as guiding them towards the Division of Elections to update their registration or to get registered.
Okay, so the focus here on this is getting out the Native vote, but let me just say that we have a tremendous number of people of all races who are not registered to vote and who don't take part in the electoral processes, and that's really the critical component here is we all need to be
part of this. Yes, it's a nonpartisan effort.
Yeah.
And this event is open to everyone.
Wonderful.
We'd love to see everyone in the community come.
Okay. Thank you very, very much for coming in. Thanks for alerting us to this. Tuesday night, get out the vote at the Elizabeth Bratfish Center from 5 to 8 p.m. Light snacks and a little entertainment, a little information, and all that sort of stuff. Thank you very much. Thanks for all this work you're
Thank
doing,
you.
Too.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 19th of September, 2014. It's the birthday of William Golding, born in Cornwall, England, 1911. His first novel, also his best-known book, Lord of the Flies, written when he was working as a schoolteacher, rejected 21 times before a new editor at Faber & Faber in London decided to take a chance on it. It was on this date in 1940, a Polish soldier named Witold Pilecki allowed himself to be captured by the Nazis. He was a captain in the Polish resistance, and he wanted to find out what was going on near the town of Auschwitz. His superiors thought it was just a German camp for prisoners of war, but Pilecki suspected that something else was happening. So he joined a group of Polish citizens who were being rounded up by Nazis. Pilecki, leaving behind a wife and two young children, was taken to Auschwitz. He was given a number, 4859, and he soon realized that this was a Nazi death camp. He stayed there for 3 years. He smuggled out detailed reports of what was happening, reported on the gas chambers and the ovens to dispose of human remains. And his reports were so horrific that nobody in the Polish underground believed him. His reports made their way to the British and the Americans. He suggested ways to liberate the camp, but still nothing was done. Finally, in 1943, Pilecki, frustrated by the lack of action, faked a case of typhus. He escaped from the hospital. After the war, the Polish underground recruited him to spy on the Soviets, and he was captured by the Polish communist regime, executed for espionage in 1948. It was on this day, 1819, John Keats, 24 years old, wrote his poem, which begins, "Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run, to bend with apples the mossed cottage trees, and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core." His ode to autumn. It was a productive year for John Keats, 1819. He wrote his Ode to a Nightingale, Ode to a Grecian Urn, Ode to Psyche, all in that year. Died 2 years later at the age of 25. Here's a poem for today by Fleur Adcock, 4 or 5 year old. "A snail is climbing up the windowsill into your room after a night of rain. You call me in to see, and I explain that it would be unkind to leave it there. It might crawl to the floor. We must take care that no one squashes it. You understand, and carry it outside with careful hand to eat a daffodil." I see then that a kind of faith prevails. Your gentleness is molded still by words from me, who have trapped mice and shot wild birds, from me who drowned your kittens, who betrayed your closest relatives, and who pervade the harshest kind of truth to many another. But that is how things are. I am your mother, and we are kind to snails. Fleur Adcock's poem for a 5-year-old from her poems 1960 to 2000, published by Blood Axe Books, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 17 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. This is Pat Moore. I'm the host today for Juneau Afternoon, but that's such a pleasure, you can't believe it. My next guest is Jenny Palmer, and if you know anything about the State Museum, then you know who this lady is. She has been the president of the board of the Friends of the Museum, Alaska Museum, I guess, for the last 3 terms. And it's finally now. This is it.
This is it.
You can't.
So it actually
yourself.
Was not. I wasn't president for all of those. I was secretary first, and then became president.
Okay.
And the but it's been amazing because now we have moved from being just friends of the museum to the libraries, archives, and museum, mm-hmm. which is fabulous. I mean, it's just in a whole new life, and I've learned just so many more things. I mean, in the time I've been there, I've gone through 3 curators of the museum. Bruce Cato, Bob Banghart, and now we have Addison Field, all exceptional men with extremely talented in so many fields. And so it's been a fabulous thing. And I really have to look at my board. My board has been amazing. And all through the years that the Friends were in place, they've had amazing people that were presidents and board members and really worked hard to work with the museum staff to have a place that people really want to come. And so since I'm going to be changing my life a little bit, I'd like to sing some of the accolades of all of these things. And so one of the things that has been really important is many of you will remember Ethel Montgomery, and she established a scholarship for the Native Alaska Native students who were majoring in museum studies. Mm. Ethel Montgomery was one of the first docents at the museum. And she gave some money, and the board went together, and we got into an investment program that where it is now producing. We have given scholarships for about the last 4 years to Native students who are interested in museum studies, which includes libraries and archives now. And Jackie Schobert and Marjorie Menzie have been the two gals that have set the parameters for that. And we've done... We worked with the architects to establish a new store for the museum. And wait till you hear this. This store is going to be 3 times the size of the other one. Hmm. It's going to be absolutely amazing. When you walk into the building, you'll see it right away. We've been working on a business plan. Maria Yucatel has been really instrumental in that, as well as changing the bylaws that now include the libraries and archives. We've also had... We have a reception guru, Bev Kelton, who has been really wonderful. She was a former teacher at the high school and has done receptions for people of over 1,000 people, which we had at our last opening at the museum, and many other things, as well as a membership plan that Rebecca Burns has been working on. So this board has been amazing, and the museum staff have been awesome. I was in there one day before the building came down. You know, people in Juneau said, why are we bringing down this building? Well, they didn't realize because the museum staff was so accomplished in keeping it going. So I was in there one day, and this tourist came running around the corner, and she said, you know, there's some watercolors hanging over here, and there's water running down the wall. And everyone went, oh, my goodness. And so they went over, and they took the watercolors off, repaired the wall. And I was in there a week later, and you wouldn't even know that it had happened.
Hmm.
So the museum staff is to be thanked for all the care they have taken of all of the things in the museum. They've been amazing. And especially, I'd like to thank the legislature for recognizing that this building is really important for the archives, libraries, and museum. Really, and every single one of those men and women should be thanked for saying, we're going to go ahead and do this. We're going to create a building here. Because this, although we talk about this building being in Juneau, of course it's here in Juneau, but it's a state facility. And every single one of those people in the archives, the libraries, and the museum, all that staff reaches out throughout the state to all of these different organizations that need help. The archives just recently brought in all of these archives from the National Archive that closed in Anchorage. Mm-hmm. We all heard about that.
Mm-hmm.
And without Dean Dawson's getting on that right away and working with the staff and everything, we would maybe have not gotten as many of the archives as we got. And it's just fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
And our membership base, we'd love to have more members, of course, even though I may not be right there, but our membership base really helps support us. And if you want to become a member, you just need to call me at 789-5586. That's my phone number. I'll be hanging around through November and December yet. And or you can email me at BG, that's Boy Girl Palmer, at GCI.net. And if you would like to be a member of this dynamic board, you just have to let me know. Because it's really fun. And you meet these amazing professionals that are really professionals. Our state should be really proud that we've got them, as we do.
I'm curious, can you kind of describe, you've described so many of these projects that have gone on. How does the interaction between the friends of the museum and the professional staff of the museum work? Are you in an advisory capacity? Or
no, we're not an advisory capacity. It's kind of a symbiotic relationship between the two things, where we support each other in a lot of ways. And so what happens is that because we're a nonprofit, we can accept grants and money for and direct it to
the friends. Okay.
Yeah, the friends can take those grants and monies, private monies, into the friends organization, and then they can be directed to the museum or the library or the archives. Mm-hmm. For example, Bob DeArmond died fairly recently. He was a very famous historian, and his son developed a memorial fund, and that fund is held by the Friends of the Alaska State Museum and Libraries and Archives. And when the library needs money, we facilitate and help get the, have them get that, whatever they need from that money. The same goes with the museum. For many years, the Rasmus Foundation has been amazing in providing money to the Alaska State Museum for their collection. So the Friends do that. We, if there is dignitaries coming to town or the legislature, we provide things that in packets for the legislature. We also make sure that there are receptions, that they're well entertained. We provide a number of things in that order. We help with different statewide organizations that relate, like the Historical Society, over the years. This is the first year we've missed in some time to provide them with auction items. We do the same thing with the Jack when the Jack has auction items, trying to support them as an arts community. So we're really, really involved, and we work right together with them. We write a newsletter, which I see you have a copy of my newsletter, probably from Jeff. And we write a newsletter for all of our friends of the Alaska State Museum that keeps them current on the different things that are coming up in the libraries and archives and museum now, of course. And that is all supported by the staff in these various organizations. The staff many times will contact me, and they'll have something really interesting going out. We recently have tied in another connection, and that is the Talking Library in Anchorage. The Talking Library is amazing. They have the ability to provide to people who are losing their sight a special recorder, and they have lots of books and lots of periodicals that come to a person free of charge. And so there's so many things, and all those things are funneled through the Friends, and we then are trying to get them out to our Friends group and to the public.
So yours is a statewide organization.
It is now.
It mm-hmm. is.
Yeah.
So you have members. When you have a members meeting, it brings people from all over the state.
Yes. Not mm-hmm. always. But, you know, people, it's harder for people to travel. But we do encourage them to come. We also have a number of members, interestingly, in the lower 48 that I think come as tourists. And we try to always have our newsletters present when they came to the museum. And as a result, they've become members. And so, and that's really nice because it kind of connects everybody together. And they can always look at our website, too, online, which I don't remember our website name, so don't ask me.
I spend some time in my in the rest of my life driving tourists around.
Uh-huh.
And I cannot tell you how many people have expressed sorrow over the fact that the museum is closed for the renovation, because they had planned this as part of their visit. They had planned to visit the museum because they'd heard from other people what a fabulous museum it is. I'm not sure that there's that much business to the library and archives, but having them all in the same facility is going to be a major thing. Was that how closely tied were you with that vision?
Well, not really. That kind of came after the fact. The things I worked on were the store, and of course, then I told them that, having been a traveler myself, a lot, I travel quite a bit, that the woman's bathroom needs to have a lot of stalls. Now that that seems silly, but you know, Centennial Hall is making that same change, and so but it is a researcher's dream. I did research when I was younger, and to have the archives, libraries, and museum together, I mean, how wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, because you can look up things in the archives, go and read about them in the library.
And then go look at them.
Go and look at them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And all of the staffs are working really hard to bring all of that together.
Uh-huh.
And it is really interesting because I've learned so much about the archives. In fact, I wrote an article for the newsletter, this last newsletter, about the archives, how many things that they do.
It's delightfully titled. It's the importance of the state archives, but the pitch is basically that archives have saved lives.
Oh, yeah.
And I was reading through the articles here, and they're quite good. You should make this available to the general public.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when I started going through those and working with Dean Dawson, you know, it was really interesting because they have done so many things. I mean, one of the little blurbs that he gave me was about this place in Pennsylvania, and where they had this mine accident, and they went to the archives and looked up in the archives where tunnels were that had been no longer used, and they were able to find all the miners that had made it into a tunnel. And they wouldn't have known that they were there except for the archives.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really amazing what they do.
Yeah. And so unknown. It's like, yeah, it really is.
Well, look at that leaky building over there. I mean, my gosh, yeah. Thank goodness they're going to be out of that. And it's the same can be said of the circulation library and the historical library. Equally as fascinating. I mean, mm-hmm. They've got so many records and have been and taken such good care of them for all of us. And we can go and ask to see them at any time.
We've seen, I interview a lot of authors on this. Mm-hmm. Will they pass through and they're on all of the different versions of Juno Afternoon. And it's amazing when you get a book that has great illustrations in it, and then you look at the credit for the illustration, and mm-hmm. again and again and again, it's the library, it's the historical collection.
Yeah.
And the sheer volume of photography over there's got to be just overwhelming. But they do a wonderful job of making it available to people who are doing research. And they really do. Yeah.
And we've had people here in Juneau. I don't know if you remember Joe Alter or not, but he gave all of his collection of early photographs to the library, the historical library. And we just recently had La Perouse come in to town, or his representatives from France, and they also brought. Or they looked at the various records because La Perouse was here and went into Lituya Bay way back in the 1800s.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, and then his ship was eventually lost. He never made it back to France. But fortunately, he had passed off his information to another captain, and that did make it back.
Mm-hmm.
And that society is still in existence. And we have people here in Juneau, Kathy Ruddy and Jackie Schobert, that are directly connected with the La Perouse Society and work with both the museum here and with them in France. So it is just a very vital place. I mean, and we're very fortunate and that the Friends Group have been able to participate in that. And I feel really honored to have been a part of it. I mean, it's a dynamic board, and as I said, would recommend anybody to become a member and just to get the newsletter, of course. But then I would also recommend that they ask to be on the board because sure. They would love it.
Jenny, what's the next plan?
What's the next plan?
Yeah. I mean.
Well, I don't know. I'm going to be...
When is the first time that you don't... go chair a meeting?
It will be probably be January. We have our annual meeting is the 8th of November.
Okay.
And it's going to be held here at K2 actually.
In the 360 space.
Yeah. And so and we're hoping people will come, if not just to say goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be my last official meeting to chair.
Mm-hmm.
And then normally we don't meet in December, and then we start up again in January. The board usually meets the third Thursday in every month, and everyone is welcome. We're meeting right now in the SOB, and sometimes we're up there. You can see us through the glass window that goes into Bob Banghart and Linda Thibodeau's office where we meet. But we welcome everybody, and that anybody that has ideas would just like to come in here. It would be wonderful.
So third Thursday in January, you're going to be sitting on a beach where?
I'm thinking Australia.
Australia?
But maybe not on the beach. If I'm on the beach, I'll be way away from the water because I don't want to get eaten by anything.
Oh, okay. Well, Australia sounds pretty good. It should be high summer there Thursday in January, so be about 90 degrees.
So I won't have to shovel snow.
No, you won't be doing that. So, and then when will you come out of this foolish concept you have of being retired and become chairman of what next board?
Well, I don't know. I'm just kind of looking around. I just have enjoyed so many things that I've done. I think I've just, you just are always learning, you know, and it's wonderful. But I'll be back probably in mid-February, and then hopefully because February is always such an awful month in Juneau, you know. By the time you get through February, you feel like you're almost arriving. So, yeah.
Okay. Jenny Palmer, thank you so much for your years of wonderful service on the board of the Friends of the Museum. And thank you for telling us a little bit more about the operation of the board and your next plans and all of these things. and a huge roar of applause for your work.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Bye.
Tonight on 360 North at 8, Bill Walker and Byron Mallott, independent candidates for governor and lieutenant governor, answer reporters' questions on Forum at 360. Beyond These Walls, Building Community Through Public Art, follows at 9. Great Decisions in Foreign Policy is at 10, with Platts Energy Week, BioCentury this week, and BBC Newsnight following. It's a great way to look at public affairs tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
It's just a few minutes before 4 o'clock, and our last guest here, we'll only have a couple of minutes with him. Brian Graceland is here. You're going to be playing music on the fly out at the airport, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So what you're going to be doing while you're doing out there?
I do a variety of gospel music. I do a lot of traditional hymns, a lot of numbers by Dallas Holm, Bill and Gloria Gaither, Andre Crouch. I also do a variety of praise and worship music, specifically stuff from the 1980s put out by the Maranatha Singers, and also in the 90s, The Vineyard came out with 15 albums, and Toronto Live around 2000. So it'll be a variety of acoustic gospel music.
Brian, what time do you start?
6:30.
Tonight?
Sunday night.
6:30 Sunday night. This is open to the public. It's designed to kind of catch the traveler's eye, but nonetheless, people who from this community want to wander down. Where were you playing? In where those couches are over by the window downstairs? Or?
I was told it would be downstairs at the bottom of the escalators,
yeah.
And they'll have some banners set up in a designated area.
Right underneath the bird sculptures that hang down from the ceiling there in the place. So, Brian Graceland, Music on the Fly this weekend. Thank you so much for giving of your time.
Thank you.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay, we tune to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Switzer Creek, it's K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. And in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, KTOO is on K210 AS at 89.9. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. Monday at 3, a Juno afternoon, Scott Burton will be hosting. He'll have a number of interesting guests, just as we have had today, so be sure you tune in. Time now for All Things Considered.